This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. The 160th anniversary of Abraham Lincoln's visit to Kalamazoo is being celebrated this weekend. Coming up, WMUK's Andy Robbins talks with the chairman of the steering committee for the Kalamazoo Abraham Lincoln Project, Cameron Brown. But first, the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution was ratified 96 years ago this month. It gave women the right to vote throughout the nation. How women voted in the 1920s and 30s, the early elections after getting the right to vote, is the focus of a new book, Counting Women's Ballots, Female Voters from Suffrage Through the New Deal, is co-authored by Western Michigan University political science professor Kevin Corder, who joins us in studio. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
And Christina Wolbrecht, political science professor and director of the Rooney Center for the Study of American Democracy at the University of Notre Dame, and she joins the conversation via Skype. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
What made you want to write a book about women's suffrage, particularly those early elections? Christina.
So women in politics in general is a long interest of mine. And of course, for most Americans, voting is the primary way in which they engage in politics. And so for women to be denied that opportunity to basically participate in self-government, to decide who is going to be the people who represent us, make laws, govern us, is a really major part of how women engage in the political world. And the achievement of the 19th Amendment is a major transformation of really women's citizenship and their place in American politics. But knowing all that, I also knew that we know a lot about the suffrage movement. We know a lot about the process that got us the 19th Amendment. And then our history books and our textbooks and our political science sort of goes away. There really was not a lot of information out there about how women actually used the vote. If you read a lot of standard textbooks, you see almost nothing about it until sort of the second wave of the women's movement emerges in the late 60s, early 70s, and then we discover the gender gap in the 1980 election. But it was as if women won the right to vote, but our knowledge of what they actually did with that was almost non-existent. And so I was really curious about that and was lucky to have the opportunity to work with Kevin to try to help us learn something all these years later, almost 100 years later, about how women actually use those ballots that they fought so very hard to secure.
But you tell us early on that this is not an easy question to answer because we really don't know how individual voters cast their ballots based on the official records that we have. And of course, back in the 1920, 24, 28, 32 elections, you did not have the rather sophisticated exit polling that we have today. So give us kind of a brief description of how you went about trying to figure out how women were actually voting in these early elections.
We collected a huge amount of data on from the U.S. Census about the proportion of women in various counties and wards and townships, and another set of data with the election returns, and merged those together and used a relatively new or novel statistical technique to recover the individual level behavior. We did have one state, Illinois, where they counted women and men's ballots separately. They had red and blue ballots. And because we were able to see in a couple of places or a couple of states in Illinois, in a couple of elections in Illinois, the way women voted, we could verify or validate that the approach that we used using aggregate data actually worked.
Now, of course, these elections that we're talking about had some kind of big events surrounding them. There was the debate over prohibition. Of course, the Great Depression comes along in the late 1920s. So there's a lot of, as we call them, extraneous variables in there. How do you kind of tease out what might have affected swings in the electorate in terms of those factors, kind of traditional political factors, from having women vote for the first time?
I think it's fair to say that we saw a number of the things that you've described as really opportunities. So while there isn't a lot of good or wasn't a lot of good hard data about how women actually voted during this period, if you looked really closely, there were certainly some ideas. So you mentioned progressives. Women had been leaders of the progressive movement. The temperance movement had been a big part of progressivism. Women had been leaders of that. And so you might expect then that, boy, if women were given the opportunity to support progressive candidates, we'd expect them to do so. Well, in 1924, just the second presidential election after the 19th Amendment, there was a major progressive candidate for president, Robert M. La Follette. And so that election lets us look really directly at that sort of question. Did women actually in general. We see them as leaders in this movement, but when it came to voting, did they actually show up for the progressives? Or you mentioned the New Deal, when we have this huge change in American politics. The Republicans have been the absolute dominant party from the end of the Civil War. Well, the New Deal, the Great Depression changes all that, and Franklin Roosevelt puts together this huge coalition of Democrats. That's a really big change. And we might think that new voters, like women, might have contributed to that in unique or different ways. And so being able to look at those elections, which are, again, just the fourth and fifth presidential elections after the 19th Amendment, are really great opportunities to get a different sense of how women voted under different conditions.
The 19th Amendment was enacted on August 26, 1920, and as you note in the book, that is not very long before Election Day. Did that blunt maybe the impact that the women's vote could have had on the 1920 election?
It's certainly true that there was only a short number of weeks, I'll get it wrong if I try to say exactly how many, between the actual ratification. That anniversary is actually this Friday, which is now recognized as Women's Equality Day, when the 19th Amendment was ratified, and that November election in 1920. That being said, it was pretty clear that summer that it was fairly inevitable that the amendment was going to be ratified. Which state would put it over, it ended up being Tennessee, was unclear, but there was a pretty good sense that the amendment would in fact be ratified. So some states actually took steps beforehand to help women trans become voters, basically. And so in some states where, for example, women were allowed to vote on school boards already, there were some states that gave women limited suffrage like that. Those states already sort of rolled women over from the school board registration list to the regular voting lists. So we saw that in some places. In many other states, in that period from the ratification of the 19th Amendment before the election, they held special registration days just for women. They had extended hours where they'd be open at nights and weekends. Boston's a great example of this. The Boston Registrar, almost in a complaining sense, in their official documents in 1920, talks about what an expense it was to have extra registrars and extra time to ensure that women who wanted to register to vote in advance of 1920 could. That being said, the fact is that in four southern states in 1920, women still were not able to vote. Those states had very long registration periods. You had to register at least 6 months in advance of the election. Those state legislatures could have chosen to waive that requirement for women. They chose not to. And so they basically said, oh, sorry, women, you missed your chance to register to vote, and you will have to sit out the 1920 election, despite the ratification of the 19th Amendment, and we'll see you in 1924.
Were there efforts ongoing beyond 1920 to make it more difficult for women to vote in any way?
Well, it's worth saying a couple of things. First of all, the ratification of the 19th Amendment theoretically enfranchises all women. Of course, for women of color, particularly in the South, where most people of color live during this period, those women face the same barriers to voting that African-American men did. And so for them, true enfranchisement would not be realized until the 1960s, and particularly the passage of the Voting Rights Act in 1965. Beyond that, certainly different states had different regulations about voting, as we've already suggested. And one of the findings that comes out of the book is that things like literacy tests, poll taxes, other sorts of barriers to voting seem to impact women to a greater extent than they did men. Women became even more reluctant to vote when they were faced with sort of that extra hurdle for getting to the ballot box.
Gordon had asked about how did we control for other factors when we tried to look at men and women. So the sample of states that we used had a variety of conditions. Some were highly competitive. Some were one-party dominant. Some were very relaxed restrictions about voting. Some were very strict requirements for early registration. So we were able to see how women behaved across these contexts. And as Christina said, we found that the weight of electoral laws was much stronger or bigger for women. We also found that competition mattered. In places where elections were competitive, even in the presence of restrictive laws, women turned out to vote pretty impressive rates.
So if we look at the 1920 election, it was a good year for the Republicans. Did women contribute to that significantly?
Sure. It's to say it's a good year for the Republicans would be an understatement. We're talking over 60% of the vote for Warren Harding. And so it was over 60% of the vote for both men and for the newer women voters. And women were just a little bit more supportive of Harding, especially in the states where the Republican Party had been traditionally strong.
So the 1928 election saw the Democrats nominate Al Smith. He campaigned in part on a promise that he would work to repeal prohibition. And of course, the women's movement had been big in trying to get prohibition enacted. So did Al Smith out of the gate hurt himself with women voters by pledging to try and repeal the 18th Amendment?
Well, there was this sense that at the time that the Smith candidacy and the issue of prohibition would really stimulate huge turnout among women. And even retrospectively, when people looked at it, they kind of bought into that assumption and said that this election was one where women really entered in large numbers. But what we found was the Smith candidacy didn't just mobilize women, it mobilized men as well. So there were huge numbers of men who entered the electorate at the same time as there were huge numbers of women entering the electorate. So it wasn't just about women being motivated by these issues that people were passionate about. It was men and women. So that election, the kind of expectation that women were going to come in and just support him because of or oppose him because of prohibition, we didn't find that. In fact, we found that in states that were highly Democratic, the women remained supporters of the Democratic Party, and in states that were Republican, they remain supporters of the Republican Party.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that 1928 really highlights is, you know, we talk about women voters as if there's some undifferentiated mass. And so that election was highly mobilizing, as Kevin said, of both men and women. But for women and men as well, on both sides of the issue. So for many immigrants and immigrant women who had not previously either been able to vote, the naturalization process takes a while, there have been huge numbers of immigrants coming to the United States in those the decades preceding 1928, they were excited to vote for Al Smith, for their, another immigrant ethnic from New York, really sort of seemed to represent. He's, of course, the first Catholic nominee. And so in northeastern states, where huge percentages of the population were first and second generation immigrants in the 1920s, a lot of that mobilization is for Smith. In other parts of the country where the population looks different, where you have more native-born whites who tend to be Protestant, there they were sort of aghast at the possibility of a Al Smith presidency because of prohibition, because of anti-Catholic sentiment, for lots of reasons. And there, again, for both women and men, the mobilization was against Smith. So it's really important to remember that just like men, women are affected by all sorts of different interests, concerns, and characteristics.
So then we move to 1932. Of course, in the intervening years, there's the Great Depression. The Democrats nominate Franklin Roosevelt. But as you note in this book, the way that there's a shift from one party to another is that there are some voters who have voted Republican in this case who decide, well, I'm going to vote Democratic because of what has happened. And then there's also bringing in new voters. And you raise an interesting point here about perhaps women had not fully formed their partisan identity, even if they'd been voting Republican and had only been for a few elections. So does it seem to be that women were more likely, if they had voted Republican in the past, to vote for the Democratic candidate for president and maybe other offices in 1932?
Well, I think, as you mentioned before, we found that women entered the electorate as supporters of the major party in the region where they were entering the polls. And so they were a little bit more supportive of Republicans in those early elections. And then we find that they're a little bit more supportive of the Democrats in the later elections. So that would suggest that women were brought in to the electorate and more Democratic than men, and women who were currently Republican defected at a little bit higher rate. But the differences are fairly modest in terms of the defection rates. So women came in a little bit more loyal to Republicans, and then they moved a little bit more in favor of the Democrats. So higher defection rates, but not by a large number.
So do one of you, or maybe both of you, want to explore this topic more? Is this something that we could see another book about, or at least maybe some more research on women's voting behavior in the near future?
Yes. So actually, we are. So we're working on a book that combines our research on the early voting behavior with some recently reclaimed polling data from the Gallup organization that has data about women's vote choice through surveys from 1936 to 1945, and then WorldTap contemporary data to come up with the kind of entire record from 1920 until through 2016 for a century of votes for women. And so the plan is to see how our findings from the 20s and 30s lined up with the polling data and the more recent and contemporary to really see how women's voting both evolved since we looked at it in the 1920s and 30s.
Well, I guess we'll have to do this again somewhere down the road.
Absolutely.
Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Gordon.
Kevin Corder is a political science professor at Western Michigan University. He joined us in studio. Christina Wolbrecht is a professor of political science and director of the Rooney Center for the Study of American Democracy at the University of Notre Dame. She joined us via Skype. They are co-authors of the book Counting Women's Ballots, Female Voters from Suffrage Through the New Deal. This is WMUK's West Southwest. Abraham Lincoln visited Michigan only once. He came to Kalamazoo to give speeches in Kalamazoo's Bronson Park 160 years ago, 4 years before he became president. The Kalamazoo Abraham Lincoln Project is marking the event Saturday at the Kalamazoo Public Library. Former State Senator Cameron Brown is the chairman of the project's steering committee. He spoke with WMUK's Andy Robbins.
Cameron, can you kind of set the scene? What was it like in 1856 when Lincoln got here?
Well, when Lincoln arrived in Kalamazoo, and he was scheduled to speak at 2 o'clock, the train pulled in shortly before that, and he didn't have a lot of time to get to what is now Bronson Park. And there were upwards of 10,000 people gathering in the park. That was quadrupled the size of Kalamazoo at that time. So people had come in from all over the state for a political rally. It was a rally to support John C. Fremont, who was a candidate for president at the time. So Lincoln had been invited. It was the only time that he came to Michigan, the only public appearance in Michigan, and the only time he stepped outside of Illinois all that year.
Fremont was the first candidate nominated by the Republican Party for the presidency.
That is true. Lincoln was the first Republican elected.
And, in fact, won 4 years later.
With Michigan's help, 4 years later, this virtually unknown visitor to Kalamazoo was elected our president, again, with Michigan's help.
Do we know what Lincoln said when he was here?
Well, we do indeed. We have his speech. It was thought lost for many years, but was found in the 1930s, actually, in a bound volume of the Detroit Advertiser that had fallen behind a shelf in the Detroit Library. And so we have it. The Kalamazoo Public Library has posted it. You can read it online. It's a for the most part, not one of his notable speeches, but there is a little statement that he makes in there. He a wonderful Lincoln flourish of language, and it will be used in the video that we will premiere at Saturday's event.
Did he have a friendly, receptive audience, or were there some who didn't care for what he had to say?
Well, Lincoln was a little more of a moderate at that time. The hardcore abolitionist favored immediate emancipation. Lincoln was not there yet. So some of his comments, had a typical audience response. But I think on balance, 4 years later, Michigan came out and supported his candidacy.
Of all the places in Michigan, why Kalamazoo? I mean, Detroit even then was much bigger. There were other towns that were much bigger than Kalamazoo. Why did he come to Kalamazoo?
Well, he came for political reasons, and Dr. Tom George has done some rather original some wonderful research that explores that. And Dr. George will be one of the presenters Saturday at the 160th anniversary celebration, commemoration, and this will be at the Public Library in the Van Dusen Room. So I'm not going to steal Tom's thunder, but please come out, and you'll hear Tom talk. Also, Bill McElhone from the Kalamazoo Valley Museum will be speaking as well about Lincoln-related exhibits and artifacts they have there at the museum. The Kalamazoo Public Library will be showcasing their collection of Lincoln books. And for heaven's sakes, I have to put this in. The kids are strongly encouraged to join their parents Saturday. There's a Lincoln reenactor, a Lincoln and Mrs. Lincoln reenactor, so you can have your picture taken with President Lincoln. So we encourage you to attend.
The answer to this question may appear to be obvious, but perhaps is not. As we mentioned, this is the 160th anniversary of Lincoln's appearance in Kalamazoo. Why is it important to mark that event so many years later?
Well, I think in learning about Lincoln's visit, we learn about America. We learn about the relationship between state government and federal government. We learn about the Constitution. We learn about the deep undercurrents of race in America. Do we relegate this visit to an item in the history books, or do we make it relevant today? And this steering committee that is sponsoring tomorrow's event, Saturday's event, met for a number of months 3 years ago and really determined that Lincoln's visit was an untapped resource for Kalamazoo. No other Michigan city can make this claim of this visit by one of the world's greatest statesmen. So we think it's this wonderful gem, a gift of history, and we're going to explore how that can be relevant for us today, both culturally, educationally, and economically.
Did Lincoln have any further contact with Kalamazoo from that point until the end of his life in 1865?
I'm not sure that I can adequately answer that. I don't think that Kalamazoo certainly was important to his election bid 4 years later. The exact degree of contact, I couldn't say. In fact, he thought that his speech, he did not realize that it had been taken down verbatim just on a wonderful appearance of a reporter from Detroit who just happened to be at that area where Lincoln spoke, because there were other more prominent speakers. So he actually thought there was no speech that he gave that year, really, that was preserved, but this speech was.
That's kind of interesting, because a Lincoln scholar, Harold Holzer, recently published a book about Lincoln's relationship with the press. And in fact, Lincoln at one time owned a German-language newspaper, co-owned it in Illinois, and used it to help further his political career there. He apparently took some pains to make sure that newspapers got down what he said.
He did indeed, and that German connection, of course, was his linkage with John Nicolay, who went on to be one of his personal secretaries. He just did not think that his speech had been duly noted in the paper, but it was. And you mentioned Harold Holzer. He actually has included mention of this speech in one of his recent publications. And it's interesting, as the speech becomes more popular, quite often they leave out one word, and it's the word so. So much prosperity. And the Kalamazoo Public Library has the speech available online, and of course they have that word in there.
Thinking back to a conversation I had some years ago with former Senator George, who you've mentioned, there were two newspapers in Kalamazoo at that time, I believe, the Gazette and the, I forget the name of the other one. And as was typical of that time, they tended to cleave to one party or the other. And I recall him saying that they also took down or reported on the speech, but had radically different versions of it.
Yes. Politics was no different then than it is today. And I think Tom is going to touch on this, what the local paper had to say about Lincoln, or didn't have to say. But very typical of the times. Just encourage the community to come out to hear what Dr. George has to say. And incidentally, we're going to go across the street to spend some time in the park, in Bronson Park, and talk about Lincoln's speech there and where the statue has been approved by the Kalamazoo City Commission for placement in the park.
It's the Kalamazoo Telegraph was the other newspaper. My memory came back. Where exactly did he speak in the park? The marker currently is next to what used to be referred to as the Indian Mound, although it isn't an Indian Mound, really.
Well, the current state historical marker is indeed close to the Indian Mound. It's uncertain exactly where Lincoln spoke. There's some stories that he may have spoken over the mound. There was a platform there, but that's not validated in any primary source. There is a stone marker in the park placed many years ago that says Lincoln spoke here. Is that generally saying he spoke in the park or in this specific spot where the stone is? So it's really uncertain. In fact, we do know now, and again, this is some of what Dr. George has uncovered in his research, that Lincoln spoke at least twice. Keep in mind, there was maybe four different areas where speakers spoke in the park that day. The crowd was so big, and perhaps they rotated. We don't know. But Lincoln did speak later on in the evening at another venue right near the park. So, yeah, at least had two times that we know of that he spoke.
If memory serves, there perhaps is another controversy. I believe he stayed overnight before he went back to Illinois, and there's some dispute about where he actually stayed.
Well, there's always the old saying, Lincoln slept here, but we don't know for sure. Again, Tom will touch on that a little bit. There's a couple likely spots where he may have stayed, uncertain as to the exact location.
Was Lincoln well-known nationally as well as in Michigan when he came in 1856?
He was not at all. He had been touted as a possible vice presidential candidate at the national convention, but certainly few in Kalamazoo were familiar with him. One newspaper reported him as being Abram Lincoln. No, not very well-known at all.
You mentioned that a statue is going to be erected in Bronson Park. When is that likely to happen?
That is slated for 2018. It'll be a bronze life-size statue, and the steering committee is just in the process of launching our capital campaign. We're not there just yet, but this celebration on Saturday is one of a number of events that we're going to have in the community to let the people of Kalamazoo know that this is this visit is a real gem for us. The statue is just one component of our goals and plans to use Lincoln's visit for the benefit of the people of Kalamazoo. We certainly want to sustain a Lincoln exhibit in the community. The Kalamazoo Valley Museum has done a fine job with a new Lincoln mural and wonderfully done, especially for kids to see. We are looking to establish a Lincoln Leadership Development Center with a focus on youth, using all the wonderful values that represent Abraham Lincoln. So we have kind of a three-pronged approach to using this gift of history. But the statue is probably the most pivotal part, the most tangible part, and we're targeting 2018 for the completion of that project.
If there's only one thing that people could take away from the event on Saturday, what would you hope it would be?
That Lincoln's visit adds value to Kalamazoo, to the community. It adds value because it enriches our understanding, as I said before, of the proper role of government, the Constitution, the relationship between state and federal governments, understanding our past, the struggles that we've had to secure the freedoms and liberties that we have. And of course, Lincoln is kind of divides our history. The fact that he came here is a real gift to us that we really need to tap into. And it makes Kalamazoo all that much more unique in our offering of Lincoln lore.
Cameron Brown is the chairman of the Kalamazoo Abraham Lincoln Project Steering Committee. It's sponsoring the 160th anniversary celebration of Lincoln's appearance in Kalamazoo in 1856. It starts Saturday at 10 a.m. at the Kalamazoo Public Library on Rose Street. It will include reenactors portraying Lincoln and his wife Mary, as well as the premiere of a video about Lincoln's Kalamazoo connection. You'll find more information at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.